Hello once again, Narni Webbers. This is Glumpuddle.
And this is Rillian.
And we are reading The Silver Chair.
For the last few minutes, Jill had been feeling that there was something she must remember at all costs. And now she did. But it was dreadfully hard to say it. She felt as if huge weights were laid on her lips. At last, with an effort that seemed to take all the good out of her, she said, "There's Aslan."
Every time I post something on the Narni Web Facebook page, like just like a quote from a book or something, just a little something, there's always a comment, "When's there going to be movie news?"
Yeah.
It's ridiculous how long it's been since we got actual news on the movie. It's so, they are officially overdue for some kind of announcement. I don't care what it is, just,
yeah.
David McGee was seen. He was smoking a cigarette outside the office. Okay, I'll take it. You know, whatever. Some kind of news on it.
Despite how statistically probable it is that a film will be released once they start filming, it's nothing's final until it's actually released.
Well, once you have a release date and a director, and okay, we're gonna start shooting this date. Sure, I have some movies falling apart after that.
Yeah,
sure,
yeah.
But it's very rare.
Yeah. But it's much easier
so I say,
to
once
can
you,
it.
Once
when
you give
no
me a
commitment.
Release date and a director and a shooting date, okay, this movie's happening.
Right.
And we don't have any of those things yet.
Were you hypothesizing that the reason they released that press release was it because they wanted to see what the reaction would be?
Sorta, yeah, and to try to generate. I absolutely believe the wheels are turning. Douglas Gresham's very busy. He's trying to make stuff happen. There's a script being written. There's producers talking. I'm sure there's someone passing around money at some point. But there's absolutely things happening right now. But I don't think it's a sure thing, and I definitely don't think it's green lit. Once we get a director, a shooting date, and a release date, most importantly, then I'll believe, okay, this is happening. But right now, I think there's still, we got to wait and see.
It's funny how I probably think about it quite a bit, actually. Just going through the week, and I'll just think, oh, yeah, there's supposed to be a Silver Chair coming out.
I was actually thinking about that today. This afternoon, I went to see a theatrical screening of Raiders of the Lost Ark. A beautiful big screen, this perfect print of Raiders of the Lost Ark. First time I seen it on the big screen, and it was a gorgeous looking movie. But Indiana Jones is just made me think of. I was talking to my friends on the way out of the theater. I'm just tired of how every heroic character now has to be Peter Parker. Basically, they have to have superpowers and hate their lives because of it.
Yeah.
And by this day, being able to look up and go, "Oh, he's so cool," rather than, "Oh, he's so tortured. Wow, I really understand what this superhero is going through."
Yeah.
And I just think, yeah, Indiana Jones is a great example of it. So he's sort of a simple fairy tale
yeah.
character that you get excited about. And I would just, and I think Lewis finds such a great balance of characters that are kind of simple that way. Like, oh, yeah, you can kind of look up to them as these fantasy characters, but it's also they have just enough little bits of reality to make you believe in them.
Yeah, they don't make you say, "Boy, I've never. This person could never exist." I think this really ties directly into a lot of the heroism, like with Puddleglum, okay, and who's not. And I don't want to say he's at all a simple character the way Lewis wrote him, but they're. And I don't think they would. I think that Puddleglum could best stand up to the kind of reluctant hero syndrome which I think Dr. Ransom probably has the best words on stuff like this. But you look through a lot of movies; they did it with Peter. In *Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe*, they made him, you know, oh, I have all this responsibility and I have to lead all these people, but I'm just
hero.
So reluctant to do it. They did the same thing with Aragorn in *The Lord of the Rings*. You know,
uh-huh.
They had all these heroes who just are afraid to
and
accept any kind of real responsibility.
Tortured in some way, conflicted, and even the most recent version of Superman, they try to do that with him as much as the character would allow.
Exactly.
Make him morally
the only one where, and since we're talking about all these different movies. One that kind of stands out as a recent hero that I really liked, that really does seem kind of like the old school, is Captain America.
Yeah, I was just thinking
He's probably the closest thing to reluctant hero syndrome with him.
He's probably one of the closest to the Christopher Reeve Superman we've had.
He's actually kind of
in recent memory.
Just the characters. I'm not talking about the movies necessarily, but the characters of Thor and Captain America have actually become my favorite superheroes recently. Some of my favorites. I think Superman. He was my favorite as a kid, and he'll probably always be my favorite.
Superman's my favorite right now. And but one of the reasons for that, I think, is that I really miss Superman. I now every superhero has got to be all tortured and, oh no, I've got superpowers and my family died and what do I do with this responsibility? And I just miss the days of being able to look at a superhero and say, wow, they're so cool, I want to be them, rather than, wow, I feel so sorry for them. I understand what that superhero is going through. And there's a place for that.
Sure.
But I miss that Christopher Reeve Superman who could swoop in and pull a cat out of a tree. I would love to see characters in Narnia that you could just really look up to and go, wow, I'd like to be them. And I think Lewis did such a good job of creating these sort of fantasy, idealistic kind of characters. They're just simple enough to where they're clearly fairy tale characters, but then he'll throw in little bits of human details that we talked about that go, okay, but they... I believe they exist.
And even though we kind of go back and forth as far as the two different depictions of Reepy Cheep and some aspects there. Even with Reepy Cheep in the films, I felt like overall they tried to bring that. You know, they didn't try to do anything
in the Prince Caspian film. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah,
they didn't try to give Reepy Cheep a tragic backstory or anything.
There's a reason that there's only one Lord of the Mice.
Oh no, I must avenge my parents' death. I must bring Anna back to Narnia. Oh no, I'm so morally conflicted. No, you're Reaper Cheep, you're a mouse, and you're a knight, and you're awesome.
Exactly.
Not that there's not a place for that in stories, but I just think that Hollywood's too excited about that right now.
Yeah. Adam Vintage just tweeted.
What did he tweet?
I said, who's going to be the first person to get a shout-out? He tweeted, I am, !!
Congratulations! Not quite a live... Well, I had to edit this, so it's not going to be exactly live, but congratulations, you win nothing. Once again, you get the no prize. But, we last left our heroes having destroyed the Silver Chair and partially accomplished their mission. They found Rillian, and now I think there's kind of this sense of, oh, we've kind of done it, but now the Lady of the Green Kirtle walks in and reminds them, no, we actually haven't. We've actually still got some work to do before we've actually accomplished our mission.
Yeah. And here's a quick question. Were you surprised that the... Because I think I remember enough about the my first experience with the book. I think I actually, because I was so caught up in the moment, I wasn't trying to, and maybe it's because I was younger, I wasn't trying to read ahead, but I actually did not expect the witch to be there, at least at that point. I was actually surprised.
Did not expect her to walk in?
Yeah.
Well, I was definitely caught up in the, wow, Rillian's free, and he says he's really in this, some really memorable lines right there. It's a big emotional moment, and then sort of right at the peak of that, that's when she walks in, and it's just sort of like getting cold water thrown on you. It's
yeah.
Like, oh yeah, that's right. The witch is still out there, and they have to deal with that. So,
yeah.
If it had gone on long enough, they would have even the characters themselves would have realized we have to deal with the witch, but they don't have any time to kind of emotionally move on from we found Rillian before the witch walks in. But
yeah.
She walks in and does something kind of weird. Rather than just get, I mean, she is angry, but she, she kind of tries to play cool for a little bit, like, oh, Prince, has the fit not on you yet?
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, yeah, not having the fit anymore, okay? Silver Chair is destroyed, you know, put that in your pipe and smoke it.
Right.
Then she just reacts kind of interestingly, the way her tactic is not to, she doesn't immediately turn into the snake and try to kill them all. She goes over and throws the green powder on the fire and starts trying to convince them that there is no overland, and none of that ever happened.
That's...
There is no Aslan. There is no sun.
I hadn't ever thought of that. Thought of that. I guess she still decided she could use him.
Yeah, she clearly thinks she can use Rillian, and I guess even Puddleglum and the others she thinks may be able to serve some purpose. And that's her first tactic, is to make people forget where they came from.
Yeah.
She certainly for years has made Rillian forget where he came from. And she's going to try to do the same thing with Puddleglum and the kids, and then in a second we'll talk about the gnomes and how she's done the same thing. So that's always her first tactic, is tell people that where you came from, no, that's not what you are. And they'll try to tell them the lie. No, let me revise who you are. Let me tell you what you are. And it's a lie. So that's her first, that's kind of, and of course, where we really come from and the longing for our true home is an important theme that runs through all the Narnia stories. And I think that's one thing we're seeing here. I really love reading Jill's struggle about how she is aware of the fact that she's being enchanted, and Lewis writes, you know, which was a sign the enchantment hadn't fully worked yet. It's only when she starts to feel safe that you go, okay, now we know the enchantment's working because it feels so right.
Yeah. Well, it's and I love that Lewis kind of tackles, and this, I don't want to get too controversial, but...
sure you do.
I actually do, but there's a notion that a lot of people have that if this is the right course of action, if this is the right plan, well, you just have to have a peace about it. You should just, you should really feel at peace with it. Like, and people will avoid certain decisions. And say, well, I just don't feel at peace about it. You know, I just, I'm not saying that that's never a good thing, but the fact is sometimes the most right decisions at the most crucial crises we have in our lives truly feel bad. You know, they don't feel good. They're not ever comfortable, or they're rarely comfortable, especially if it's a difficult right decision. And so I love it. That's how it's portrayed here. And it's kind of like how Lewis portrays it here. You know, it would be the easiest thing for all of them to just kind of give in to her enchantment.
Oh, absolutely. I think if maybe people put too much stock in feelings, and well, it doesn't feel right, it isn't, and there's absolutely a time and a place for that, but I definitely believe that the right thing does not always feel like,
right.
It doesn't always feel good or feel right. And I know that I, on a personal note, was recently trying to make a decision. And I was waiting to feel like if I do this, everything is going to be right. Everything's going to be okay. I was waiting to feel like that.
Yeah.
And eventually realized, you know, I think this is the right thing to do, even though I don't have a guarantee everything is going to be okay.
Right.
And I had to do that.
It's sort of the...
Now we're at Puddlegum speech. That's next. I'm waiting for this.
Insert applause.
You can go. Sorry. You can go ahead.
No, I just love how there's, I think though the silver chair, as far as a pattern of the children being kind of alone and really having to make, choose between the right choice or the comfortable choice, again and again and again, it's, whether it's Jill kind of,
hot baths at Harfang.
Hot baths. Even going back to the cliff, whether Jill was going to give in to her pride and not give Eustace the satisfaction of stepping back from the cliff. There's all these little points. I think that the Silver Chair probably utilizes this or displays this more than any other book. During the speech, Glumpuddle kind of says, well, even if...
Who says that?
Glumpuddle basically says, even if...
Who says that?
Oh, I did it
twice!
Two more times!
Wow! Twice
in the same paragraph, dude.
I even
ka-ching!
Wow. Oh, man. It officially can happen anytime. See, I'm lucky because, like, if I can just say Rillian, you know, your screen name isn't Ian Rill, so I don't have to worry about...
I know. So here's... I don't even remember what I was saying. Oh!
The right thing in the
Puddlegum
right thing
says, even if Rillian kills them, setting him free is the right decision.
Uh-huh.
I have a philosophical question for
Uh-oh.
You.
Uh-oh. Wow, things are about to get deep on this podcast
they
for
are.
The first time ever.
They are. And it's something that I'm kind of uncomfortable with, and so maybe you can help me with it. So, Puddleglum's speech. I had to catch myself there. Puddleglum's speech to the witch.
The most epic thing ever, you mean?
Yeah. His response. What do you think is the essence of his? I'm going to live like a Narnian, even if there isn't any Narnia.
Well, the idea behind that, and that could be take. I think that could easily be misinterpreted, is that I don't care what the truth is. Even if there is no Narnia, I'm going to live as though there is. But I think the logic behind it is that if it's true what you're saying, you know, she's trying to say there is no sun, there is no overland, you know. This lamp is the real thing. The sun was just a dream or whatever. Mm-hmm. If that's all true, then what's the point of anything? Everything, you know, then everything is going to decay and die at some point. The scientific fact, the, you know, our world is going to come to an end at some point, and then nothing will matter. So if that's true, then what is the point of anything? So I might as well live like a Narnian, even if there is no Narnia.
That is, I had honestly not quite thought of it that way. I could see him, I kind of saw his, because I knew that, you know, Lewis wasn't obviously, because obviously Lewis isn't saying, well, it doesn't matter what's true. But I was wondering, well, maybe he's saying that, well, these things are so good that even if what you're saying is true, these things are still better because of how good they are. But I like what you're saying better. Because, yeah, there is no point.
Well, so Puddleglum says, then, like, if all that's true, there is no Overland. In that case, the made-up things seem a good deal more important than the real ones. And it's just, if this really is all that there is, then that's kind of sad and probably pointless too. And so,
and how kind of, it's kind of, it kind of implies a question: how can the made up things seem more important than the real ones?
Yeah, you could take Puddleglum's kind of speech a step further and say, yeah, why is it that the things that we might dismiss as made up, but why do they seem so important? And why can't we just throw them away and dismiss them? And what is it about them that seems to ring so true? Is there something true about that? And that's one of the questions that C.S. Lewis and a lot of his other writings was most focused on trying to answer. But here, I mean, like, this is probably as good a time as any to go ahead and call Puddleglum the hero of the book again. And he stamps out the fire and he pulls them all out of the spell.
Did you want to answer the question from Wagga again then?
Which we got a question about from Wagga Werewolf again. And just saying that it's Puddleglum's steadfast guidance that saves the day again and again. And actually, one of the great moments that Wagga points out, we're going to answer in a few minutes here. Well, probably more than a few minutes, but one of Puddleglum's great moments Wagga points out here is when he persuades Rillian not to go to Bizm, which we'll get to in a second here. But I just think Puddleglum is the guy that just, he's going to stand by Aslan, even if there isn't any Aslan. He's got so much trust in Aslan, and he just gets it.
He does.
He just keeps on pulling them out of mess after mess in one way or another, and I can't get over how much I love Puddleglum, so I'll just stop trying to talk
about it. At the beginning of this series, you kind of talked about how Jill is the clear heroine of the story. And
so, well, she's the protagonist.
Yeah, and it's a, I don't know, I kind of see Puddleglum... You know, is he the lead protagonist throughout the pages? No, but he is the one who's, everything falls apart without him.
Yeah. So, Lady of the Green Kirtle is about to be defeated here, but before she's defeated, we should raise the question of what exactly was her plan, what exactly was her motivation? Obviously, you don't necessarily need a lot of explanation for why somebody would want to take over Narnia. Well, she wants to take over Narnia and rule it because she's a villain and she's powerful. She's a villain who wants to be powerful. You don't necessarily need a whole ton of explanation for that, but why Rillian, I guess, is the main question. We touched on this a little bit in the last podcast, but we got a question about this, a really well-written, detailed email. I wish I could read the whole thing, from Anquinos. Sorry if I'm not saying that right. But pointing out that Lewis never gave us the Lady of the Green Kirtle's exact goals and never gave us exactly how she hoped to achieve them. And the most important thing, I guess the most important question is why Rillian? And like Anquinos pointed out, Lady of the Green Kirtle seemed to feel that she couldn't take over Narnia without Rillian's help or using Rillian in some way. And so what do you think that is? Like, why do you think she wanted to use Rillian or felt she needed
to? The only thing that really comes to mind is that there was some sense of legitimacy to Rillian. And I could still say, well, why? You know, the White Witch ruled Narnia. Maybe the Lady of the Green Kirtle thought, well, I don't know. Maybe she thought that a son of Adam, who was the actual, not just someone who was the actual rightful ruler, would actually not be overthrown somehow. I don't know.
Right. That's what I've always. That's the only thing I've been able to come up with is that. What does Truffle Hunter say in Prince Caspian? It's not man's country, but a country for man to be king of. Aslan says something near the end of Prince Caspian about how Caspian, you should have known that you couldn't actually rule Narnia unless you were a son of Adam yourself. So I do wonder if the Lady of the Green Kirtle has somehow figured this out or has this notion of, okay, son of Adam, seems like they have to be king of Narnia. So instead of trying to take it over, which seems doomed to fail, I'll just puppeteer a son of Adam.
I don't. I still don't understand kind of
Rebrilliant, of course, being descended from Caspian, who was descended from the pirates that came from our world. So effectively, Rebrilliant is the son of Adam.
Yeah. Do you think it's kind of interesting that the witch turns into a gigantic snake, whereas she didn't
and not
before?
A small one? Yeah. Which makes you wonder, well, can she turn into anything else? Or is it just, well, she can turn into a snake and it can be big or small depending on her needs.
I guess. As she's dying, she's thinking, I should turn into a gigantic snake, you know, but I don't know.
Yeah, okay, the little one's not... It would be pretty funny if she accidentally turned into a little one. That'd be a really short fight scene. Maybe for the, like they do in Pixar, if they do fake outtakes for the Silver Chair, they could do one where she actually turns into the little snake again, and Rebrilliant just goes, oh, okay, done. But, Rebrilliant cuts off her head, but then something starts happening, and like you know, the place starts flooding and crumbling and falling apart. And they put together that that there was some sort of spell that when she died, something would happen, so that whoever killed her would be killed.
And they're ready. They're getting ready for battle because they look out the windows, and of course they see the gnomes moving around in military formations and skirking, dodging and darting about.
And it's at this point that this is maybe my biggest issue with the end of Silver Chair, and something I maybe would be very open to them changing for the movie is there's a real sense of urgency that I think is missing at the end. Like the Queen's spell clearly didn't work that well. Because they don't seem like they're in that much of a hurry, and they talk to Golg and the gnomes, and they think about Bism, and there's actually a bit where it says that Rebrilliant had to tell his story at least 10 times to the different gnomes, and so it doesn't seem like the witch's spell worked that well to kill her killer. But so I don't know. Like at the same time, there's good stuff here. I like when they find the shield. Like, that before had no device on it, Rebrilliant shield, and has, it actually looks like Peter's shield now, it's silver and has a red lion on it as a sign that Aslan will be our good lord. I love all the stuff where they go out, and the gnomes are running around, and they find Golg, and they interrogate him and talk about Bism. Oh, there's wonderful stuff in there.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you could have had that and had the sense of urgency at the same time. Possibly not.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I'm trying to, I think to a certain extent, yeah, there is a sense of urgency, but then... How long did it take them to get over to the new diggings? You know, how long were those torches actually lasting?
I feel like an hour.
They were racing against time because the torches were going out. And, you know, how quickly was the water rising? You don't really – it is hard here to get a sense of how quickly were things happening. And then you think, well, maybe –
it just doesn't seem like the Queen's spell was that effective, I guess I would say. It doesn't seem like it was ever that much of a threat. Well, look. I'm conflicted. In one sense, I feel like it just seems like the story needs some urgency. It's been kind of slow for a while.
I think
and
it's
like,
mixed. Honestly,
it's earned
I think
the right
mixed.
To have this big escape, dramatic kind of escape scene, and it's just interesting Lewis doesn't go that direction.
Reading it, and even when it was, I think, being read to me when I was younger, because that kind of stood out. You know, really had to repeat his story 10 times. You know, I'm thinking, well, that would take a while, you know. Obviously, Lewis wants to move along, and you know, so he's not even telling us, the reader, and so certainly they would want to move along too. But then you have other things, like I remember actually when Rebrilliant is standing looking into Bism, and he's thinking, I'm the reader thinking, no, we need to move, you know. So I actually at that point I felt the sense of urgency where he's kind of contemplating going.
Fascinating stuff, I think, just sort of. On par with Don Treader. Like, just up to the Don Treader level. Like, Bism is so... The idea of the world not only having an end, but having a bottom, I think is so fascinating. And when he talks about, you know, you think you've seen real gold? Come see, like, living gold. Yeah. You know, like, where he talks about eating gold and drinking diamonds and like, those creatures that are too bright to look at and so much stuff. They're like, wow, I love this.
Too
I
bright
would love
for him
to
actually
go
at.
There. What's that?
Too bright for the gnomes to look at.
Uh-huh, that's true. Yeah. You have to wonder if really might actually be able to see. And is as much as I'm kind of saying, gosh, guys, can we move it along a bit? Yeah. Like, I actually do relate to Rillian's temptation, especially when he says, wow, my father went to the end of the world. Well, it would be really cool if his son went to the bottom of it.
I think that a movie could accomplish the sense of urgency and also show a lot of Bism.
I don't know.
I think that one of the great things about Bism... I think what really took me by surprise is, you know, we understand, especially when you've read all of them, all the books, and you think, okay, there's Charn, and there's Narnia, and then there's our world. There's different worlds that you don't just walk to. But here, it's like a whole. It's not just another country. It almost is its own world that they can walk to. That's what really. Right. That's what's so amazing. That it's, you know, you think, what if, how bizarre would it be if we discovered that there was a whole civilization literally right underneath our feet? And so I think that's why Abysm kind of stands out. And you know, Lewis's imagination, I love it. It's just, and if you read, I recently finished Palandra not too long ago, and I'm thinking, okay, the alien world this man depicts is not like anything I've seen in any sci-fi ever. And same with this. You know, I haven't ever heard of a fantasy story that takes place in this kind of country. You know, it's just insane.
Yeah, I love it. I just love the wonder of
great.
Just in the same way that I wonder, wow, the end of the world, what would that be like? Like, well, the bottom of the world, it's kind of the same thing. It's like, well, what's under the bottom of the world?
Yeah.
And makes me wonder if there's something, well, and there's a top of the world, I guess. I mean, there's certainly stars up there that are alive, and there's certainly stuff going on up there and things Lewis could have written, and stars that can break rules, apparently, and get sentenced to govern the Duffelbuds because of it. What?
Hashtag mind blown. No, seriously, I hadn't even thought about that. Like, because there would be a civilization there too, in theory. I mean, Cory Arkin and Ramandu.
I love that.
You know,
but I don't know if you can have in the movie have the sense of urgency and go into detail with Bism. I almost wonder maybe BBC was trying to do that. And actually, that brings us to an audio question from Manise.
Greetings, Narnia Web. This is Manise. I was disappointed in BBC's betrayal of the gnomes, especially when they all were jumping into a pit without any explanation on why. What are your thoughts?
100% agree with Manise here. Oh my gosh. What that was, I mean, in general, this is the best part of the BBC Silver Chair. I don't love this BBC Silver Chair movie, but the Underland stuff is probably the best part of it in terms of production design and a lot of other areas.
And the Abysm is the worst part of it.
It really is. When they're and the gnomes in general are so completely different from the gnomes in the book. They're, you know, I am the leader of blah, blah, blah. I mean, they just have this, you know, enthusiasm. They're not the quiet, forgotten where we came
if
from.
If one of them bursts,
you know,
into, I am the very multiple of a multiple major general, you wouldn't be that surprised.
Right.
You could all start dancing and singing about. You know, here's a sad thing. I reached a point in my life where I had read, we'd been through all the books, but at one point I was watching The Silver Chair and my memory was not that good. And so some things I remembered. I knew, of course, I knew everything that was going to happen with Rillian, and I knew about the Queen, but I'd forgotten about Bism. It was just one of those things that hadn't really stuck with me. And I actually thought that they were all committing suicide.
Wow.
And I thought, well, Dad, why are they all committing suicide? And Dad, I think, watched that part of the movie. He says, oh, well, they're going back to the land of Bism, but they don't really show
it. Oh, gosh. Oh, but I love that stuff about them. And Bolg, I love his description of how they felt when they realized, wait a minute, I've been enchanted. Why am I doing this work? I'm not going to do this anymore. And then waking up, and that big theme of Narnia of longing for your true home. And in this case, the Silver Chair, the consequences of forgetting your true home, I guess you could say, is one of the central ideas in the Silver Chair. But I just don't know if in a movie, can you get all that wonder and develop that theme and still get maybe the sense of dramatic urgency you want?
I think you can get some of it.
I guess some of it. And we actually got a question from Thunderfist at basically asking, why did that chasm open when the Lady of the Green Kirtle died? Like, wasn't the idea that she was trying to, prevent them from going back? Why would it suddenly open when she died? Maybe all her magic, I guess, sort of undid all of a sudden when she died. The real question for me is, like, why it took so long for everything to flood and for her, the point of the spell to actually work. But, Thunderfist actually suggests, for some reason, I get the strange sense that the salamanders had something to do with it. That's certainly something for the imagination.
Don't.
You know, Lewis encourages the imagination to think about things like that. And I think that's perfectly valid, Thunderfist. It never occurred to me, but there is something about the salamanders that you can look at because they're so bright. At least the gnomes can't. that makes your imagination want to run wild and wonder. But it's, you know, and so Rillian is really getting, really actually considering going to the bottom of the world. And Puddleglum rightly says, look, do you ever want to see your, don't you think your dad would rather see you alive than know that you went to the bottom of the world? And yet, and Rillian actually says, okay, but I've left half my heart in the land of Bism. And as Wagga kind of points out, that that's another little heroic moment for Puddleglum. Because Jill is, you know, as Wagga points out, you know, is horrified by the idea. Like, no, we have to go.
Yeah, they missed claustrophobic.
And Eustace, surprisingly, is actually kind of getting into this. Like, yeah, he's kind of getting into the romance of, wow, the Prince of Narnia going to the bottom of the world.
Yeah.
And Puddleglum has to be the voice of reason and say, look, let's go.
I will say this. The line, I left half my heart in the land of Bism, is never making it into the movie.
Well, because I'm not sure if Bism will make it into the movie at all. That's the main reason.
I left my heart in... Sorry.
That'll be on the soundtrack.
Sorry.
That'll be the closing credits right there.
It beautiful. Would be.
You can get Switchfoot perform it or something. I would be
no, it'd be the Annie Lennox version.
Of course. But finally they're moving on and Golg won't dare, there's a point where Golg wouldn't dare take them any further because it's too close to the top of the world. Or what he calls the top of the world. We would probably just call the world. But they're heading up the tunnels and, there's a great line where Puddleglum says, you know, there's one good thing about being trapped down here. It'll save funeral expenses. That's one of his more memorable lines, I think. Moment of tension when Jill disappears and mm-hmm. you don't know where she is.
This is one of those things that the book can do that the movie just can't, you know, the movie can't backtrack like that, you know? And so you're going to have maybe that moment of tension, but then it'll be lost, you know?
Well, I don't know. You could see her feet going up and all of a sudden, someone's pulling on her feet disappear.
I know, but it's more protracted for Eustace and for Puddleglum and for Rillian. Because, of course, they're wondering for a while what happened to her. And she immediately, there's a snow dance, you know.
Uh-huh. And now, the snow dance is something that's another thing where you kind of think, oh, that's going to get cut. You know, there's no way they'll include that. But how cool would it be to actually see some filmmakers put a lot of thought into, okay, what would this actually look like? And how can we show this uh-huh. in a way that people will kind of get the idea? It just like if they can just have a 3-second shot of the snow dance, yeah. I would love it. But that definitely seems like something that they would cut out, unfortunately. Yeah. And it's hard because like I know if you try to get in every little thing from the book you want, and it's we have to have this. If that's how you make the movie, it's gonna fall apart. You have to just say this is the story we're telling. If you try to squeeze in all these little things, then it ends up hurting the story. If they can't make the snow dance work for the story, they shouldn't do it.
Yeah.
But man, I hope they can. I would love to see that on film.
It'd be great.
It gets really emotional here when they find everybody realizes this is the lost Prince Rillian returned, and
well,
I love
and
that.
It's
I love how they recognize him.
The queen is dead, so they know there's not going to be an heir.
Ding dong, the witch is dead.
But
I thought you were referring to the other queen. I'm sorry.
You're saying that because I'm from Kansas.
Your reaction was like, oh, wow, that was rough. Like, I thought you were referring to the Lady of the Green Curl. You're referring to Caspian's wife, excuse me.
Yes.
Okay.
Get it straight, dude.
Dong. I'm not going to ding dong because she's dead. Okay. You were saying.
So, man. Okay. Whatever. I had a thought, but it's not important now.
Talking about the emotion of this scene is when they all realize that it's Rillian and... They recognize him. There's no doubt in anyone's mind this is the lost Prince Rillian, and all the fauns and dwarfs are excited. And I love the bit where it says that, like Jill says something like, you know, all the struggle was worth it. Their whole journey was worth it when she sees what an important moment this is to the Narnians.
This is going to be something that's they're going to have to set up in the film, and we'll have to move on after this. But they're going to have to really set up the loss. Really establish the sense of
it's Narnia's
loss.
Future, you know? Narnia's whole future. Like, the line of kings is about to be broken here.
Right.
And Narnia's the whole future of Narnia is on the line.
Yeah.
So the ship returns, Caspian is carried off the ship, and everyone's excited to see him, though they can all sense that there's something wrong.
Yeah.
He basically sees his son for a few seconds, and then he dies. And in a way, it's sort of happy. Wow, we're so glad that he did get to see his son. And it's perfectly clear that if Rillian had delayed and actually gone to Bizum, it's very likely he would not have made it back in time for his father to see him. That, like, wow, all that stuff that happened, all the delays, and it all worked out. They got him there just in time.
Yeah, it's one of those things that it's kind of gratifying and frustrating at the same time. And I think that it's one of those moments, this and then when Caspian comes back, things like this, it's so important for them to really capture it. And this is one of the things I really loved. You know, the Family Radio Theater audio drama, I think probably the best one. The Horse and His Boy might be my favorite of all of those. But for the Silver Chair, this portion of it was so well done. And
with the music and the crowd and everything.
Yeah, everything. And I think that it's such a sad notion, even for the reader, just, you know, because, you know, he knows Caspian the way that Eustace knows Caspian, the way that Pevensey's know Caspian. And then, and in some ways, it's kind of weird. There's kind of a dissonance because you don't really get to know Caspian in this story. And you're kind of in the place Eustace is, where you know who Caspian is, but you're not able to spend time with the character that you love. And then he dies before even the reader is able to experience anything. So Lewis actually kind of puts you through the same experience that Eustace is experiencing here. And I think in the book you do sense that Rillian, there is this, I get this sense, he doesn't really talk about it, this sense that he's so sorry that he went after the snake and didn't listen to Drinian. And there's just this sense there of, especially when he finds out how long he's been gone, 10 years. And he just feels, you know, just 10 years of his life are just gone.
There's probably a little guilt there. Yeah. But on that rather sad note, we go to a scene that is obviously a lot more hopeful when we unexpectedly find ourselves in the Aslan's country.
Yeah.
And we see, and I love, look, we stay sad for a while here. It's not joyful yet. Like, there's real tears. The characters see the old Caspian in the water, and there's real tears. Even Aslan cries, acknowledges, even though I know I'm about to, you know, rebirth him, essentially, it's still really sad. There's an acknowledgement of just, and the same thing happens to Magician's nephew when he cries to Diggory about his mother. It's still like, look, this is still a sad thing.
Yeah. I like how there's so many different ways that people move about worlds and things. Aslan blows them to Narnia, and actually just literally blows them from one place, picks them up, puts them in another. And here he kind of, it's like he blows the world of Narnia away.
Yeah, that's right. You know, that could be a cool visual.
And I always love that image. And then, of course, they see, and I don't know, I wonder, how did Lewis think, you know, to have Caspian laying in the river? But it's just this sad image where you see someone lying still underneath the water, and you know that they're not alive if they're lying
dead
there underneath the water. And there's so many little aspects of all these. Lewis gives these little pictures in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. We get kind of a picture of how Aslan redeems and brings life. In The Voyage of the Dodon Treader, we get a very different kind of angle, equally true, but very different angle on that same kind of transformation with Eustace. And here, even just the fact that Caspian can only come back to life if Aslan experiences pain and suffers loss of blood.
Mm-hmm.
And
honestly, that makes me think of an important point for the filmmakers retelling this story, which is that if you want the joy at the end, it means you also have to have the despair at the beginning.
Yeah.
To really emphasize that joy. So you have to have the sadness of Caspian's death. You have to have the acknowledgement of Aslan and the others crying over his death to say this really is sad if you want the joy of him being reborn. Yeah, as far as this making into the movie, it's one of those things I feel like I don't know if you can quite lose it because it's so notable, but they'll find a way to really squeeze it in somehow. Like, they'll find another version of it. They'll find a way to sort of pay homage to it without actually quite doing it, because It's at this point, the story of the Silver Chair is over. Why is this in here? This really speaks to the larger
series
as a
whole. Ding dong, the witch is dead, and I'll kill the witch. And oh, yes, by the way, there's this thing called deep magic, but not deeper magic because I don't understand that.
Right.
You know, we'll just throw that in there.
But it's just, why is this here? It's sort of the question of why is it here? It becomes much more clear once you finish the story. And I really think, I'm just going to read it, the bit where the other is looking at Caspian and like, oh, but hasn't he died? You know, and with Caspian, they're kind of freaked out. And this is the heart of the series, I think. Yeah, well, of course he's died. Most people have, you know. But there's a bit here from Caspian that I really love. So Caspian says, I see what's bothering you. You think I'm a ghost or some nonsense. But don't you see? I would be that if I appeared in Narnia now because I don't belong there anymore.
Uh-huh.
But one can't be a ghost in one's own country. And that's where he is. Now he's where he belongs. And so, again, that theme in the Silver Chair of, you know, for where it is, that, or really the theme of the whole series of where do I truly belong? How Reepicheep longed for, and just for one example, Reepicheep longed for his true home in Voyage of the Dawn Treader, and he felt that it was somewhere out there, and it was somewhere east. And, of course, Shasta longs for his home, even though he's never seen it before, right at the beginning of The Horse and His Boy. And I think that having the set, rather than just having Caspian come back and, hey, everything's great, and let's go throw the football around, son, you know, I mean, rather than having it end like that, to say, I think it resonates with me as someone who lives on planet Earth where things don't always turn out well. It resonates with me so much more, the suggestion that, yes, these things do happen. They are sad. They're painful. They're tragic. They're terrible. But look, there's hope and there's healing because there's something beyond the world. I think that's a much more – that idea connects to me a lot more than just, oh, let's pretend that everything's great. Let's just have a super happy ending. Like, you know, like you said, it's gratifying, but it's also frustrating.
They need to capture that because even though that's Eustace gets to say a real goodbye to Caspian, he actually gets to spend some time with him, actually have a conversation with him. Even though he gets to say goodbye, he doesn't actually get to...
And of course, by the way, this is closing a loop that started in Dawn Treader with Caspian getting almost to the world, to Aslan's country,
true,
almost to the world's end, and then he had to get turned back. And now finally we're seeing he actually did make it there. And not only
actually,
did he finally get to Aslan's country, he gets a glimpse of our world as well.
Well, yeah, because it's two loops. Because he said how, especially when he found out that our world is round, he said...
How much you
wanted
to see?
I want to see your world now that I know that your world is like a ball. Have you ever had the sensation of standing upside down?
So he does get a glimpse of our world, and more importantly, he finally does make it to Aslan's country that he came so close to in a heartbreaking scene in Dawn Treader. It was turned back just short of it. So
yeah,
that's vitally important.
With this, here's a question for you. And I hate to keep bringing in the film and stuff. But let's talk about the book here as we're thinking about how they're going to do it. We're talking about how they really need to capture this sadness, okay? And the seriousness of it, right? The gravity of the situation.
Uh-huh.
But then we have beating the school bullies.
First of all,
how do you think it works in the book?
It's a moment of...
Because it's such
sort
a massive change as far as a... Because Lewis does kind of say, okay, we're going to end this book on kind of a humorous note.
A little bit. I think it's like... There is a sense of it's slightly absurd, of course, but there's a joy in that, things. It's certainly a reflection of how the kids have changed. I think we get to see a picture of that, and just just the hope that Jill was in this hopeless situation. You know, there's the whole term ahead of them in this horrible school, where she has no one to turn to, no one to trust, and the idea that no, there is hope. You know, help from beyond the world does come ultimately and save them from that. And Experiment House is a much better place afterward.
You know, we had the great opening to the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, which we knew wasn't going to make it in the film because it has a narrator. And I would just like to read one of my favorite portions of the Silver Chair, which I very highly doubt they would have a narrator. And so I don't think that they're going to have it in there. But I just love this. It's talking about the head of the Experiment House. And in the inquiry, all sorts of things about Experiment House came out, and about 10 people got expelled. After that, the head's friends saw that the head was no use as a head, so they got her made an inspector to interview with other heads, and when they found she wasn't much good even at that, they got her into Parliament, where she lived happily ever after. And just little things like that. I just love stuff like that.
There's no way to do that.
There's no way. But yeah, it's one of those things that we'll just.
She got along much better at Parliament than she did here. She fit right in.
Yeah.
She was much happier. Oh, how do you get little bits like that into a movie? I do not know.
It won't be in there, but you know, it's one of those things that I do like that Lewis ended it on that kind of jovial note.
I love where he's talking about how, you know, the crack that they escaped from was left open, and people would go down there and they would tell stories about Underland and all that. And the last, and you know, in those caves down there, and Lewis just ends the book with, "If you ever have the luck to go to Narnia yourself, do not forget to have a look at those caves." And I like that first because I love the fact that the last thing you read is him saying, "Yeah, Narnia's real. Hope you get to go there." And for whatever reason, it was just a thought this narrator had. Like, yeah, those caves are really amazing. I really hope you get to see them. It's just something about that gives it the sense of reality. And End of the Silver Chair, first time I read the series, it was my favorite book.
It was mine for a while, too. And then for some reason, Silver Chair took over. I'm not sure why.
So Silver Chair is still your favorite book?
I'm sorry, Dawn and Shredder took over.
What are you drinking there, dude?
It's seltzer water.
Great. I could go on and on all the things I love about it, and the themes of trust, which has resonated with me so much, especially actually very recently, things in my life have been going on where the Silver Chair has meant a lot to me, and the theme of Jill needs to learn how to trust again, even though there's the chance of getting hurt, of emotionally investing, and even though there's actually a very real possibility of getting hurt, and you can't live in fear like that. You can't let the fear of getting hurt say, well, I'm just going to stay here where it's safe, and I'm not going to invest in people.
Well, and Aslan, when Aslan gives her the quest, and this is something that I think we've hit on, but it's key. He never promises that she will survive.
Exactly.
In fact, he specifically mentions that she could die.
Or else died in the attempt, yeah. And then when Puddleglum says,
And I think that...
That's so important.
When you have Aslan saying that, it kind of relinquishes a certain amount of, even for the reader, because I think the reader kind of says, I don't think Jill will die. Yeah, but even for the reader, kind of, which kind of takes a new turn in the last battle. But
they're much more than, honestly, that's one of the reasons, just one example, honestly, of why I spend so much time talking about these and invest so much, you know, just time and effort online talking about these books. And I really want to get it out there to the filmmakers, well, you know, everyone, but the filmmakers especially, that these are not just books to me. These really, like, these books reflect things that I take very personally. And just with this, like I said, just recently, where I was making a decision, and I really, really was looking for that guarantee that if I do this, everything is going to turn out 100% peachy keen, and there's going to be no pain. And I finally had to do the thing that there probably will be pain involved, but I eventually decided it was the right thing to do. And these books have had such an influence on me. They're not just fantasy stories that you can just make and do a money-making blockbuster. I just want the filmmakers especially to be aware that these really mean something to me. And Narnia Webbers, anyone listening to this, if you feel the same way, make your voice heard. Let the filmmakers kind of feel that pressure. Not, you have to make the movie this way, but the pressure of, this story is not just escapism for people. That people, it really represents something very important and very personal to them. So make your voice heard. Internet's a cool thing.
Because these books do stand out. They are special, and they mean something to me. There's not very many books where I can say I'm a better person because these books exist.
These books have had a huge influence on my life, and now the filmmakers are the temporary custodians of something incredibly important to me. And so I don't want them to feel like, we have to do the book word for word exactly. We can't change it. I don't want them to think that. I just wanted to say, make this movie like you want to make it something special, not just another special effects fantasy movie. All right, so where are we going to go from here, Rillian? Why don't you explain that a little bit?
Well, we are going to... of course, we're going to continue with the book discussions. You know, we still have The Horse and His Boy, The Magician's Nephew, still have The Last Battle to do. What we're going to do, and we haven't exactly decided on the format, but we're basically going to talk about a wish list for the Silver Chair movie. And it's been hard. Obviously, we've talked a lot about what the movie in this series is. It's a book discussion, and we've talked about the movie, obviously, because it's on our minds. But we have been primarily talking about the book and every once in a while mentioning what they should do with the movie. But this is going to be what they should do with the movie.
Or shouldn't do.
And
it can be a non-wish list, too, if you want.
It can be a non-wish list, too. We haven't decided exactly yet. I don't know how many items we're going to try to focus on. But we're going to try to keep it kind of sweet, simple, and kind of specific on, you know what, this is really important to get right.
Yeah, I mean, if you just want to send it, it can be a really short email. Send in the podcast at narniweb.com.
Or, as short as this is going to be, it could be a tweet. You know, tweet Glump at Glumpuddle or tweet at Prince_Rillian.
Yeah. I mean, just a sense of, like, it could just be as simple as, I really want them to include this scene. Maybe if you want to, a little explanation for you guys. Or maybe this thing. Or I really want them to keep the bittersweet ending of Silverchair. Or I really want to make sure that this part is really intense. Or there was this thought that Jill had. I really think that should be reflected. Or maybe just a really specific scene or line. Or maybe something you don't want. Okay, I know I don't want this, you know, in the movie. So let's just come up with kind of a wish list or non-wish list for the upcoming Silverchair movie.
Although, be careful with the non-wish list because they can get you in
right.
trouble, as we have found out in the past.
Fair enough.
There's going to be at least one episode non-book discussion,
and then at some point we'll pick up the book discussions with the horse and his boy.
Boy, that's a great book.
Sometimes it's my favorite book. On some days it is. Most days it's Don Treader. But let's keep this going. This is great. Further up and further in.